I thank you, Father, for life. I thank you for life from the dead. I thank you for every person here, no matter what condition they're in. I ask you to bless them all. Help us all. Breathe on us, encourage us. Show us that those that are standing with us are more than those that are standing with them. And cause us to regard a cloud the size of a man's fist as the power of the age to come, the victory of Yeshua over sin and death and over Satan. And the darkness that he represents. And I ask you, Father, to help me now and use me and do what you would like in Yeshua's name. Amen. So we were talking this morning partly about whether physical actions have spiritual significance or effect, weren't we?
Yeah.
So I just want to mention, I appreciated Ruth Anna's testimony. I don't think it was just a physical action. I appreciated what Craig read. I appreciated Jerusha and my wife and my daughter and Natanya over there playing and singing. It all had spiritual effect. And I was going to say, I've been many places, including in this room, at times where I wished... And including this room, by the way, includes meetings that were not our meetings, just so that I'm clear on that. When I wish people would stop blowing a shofar, I wish people would just set their shofars down. When I knew that some of them thought that just blowing that thing was, I don't know, winning the entire battle to the end of the age, just because they blew it. But that's not the way it was when Judah blew it today. That was spiritual. That wasn't just a body blowing air through a horn. And so I just wanted you to know that, Judah. I think a lot of times... I want you all to know, actually, that what you do in Messiah isn't in vain. But if you're anything like me, you've done all sorts of things that were actually what you should have been doing and felt like they were weak and ineffective, and even that you might have failed, or that, you know, somebody else should have been the one, or... You know, it just didn't work out. Your mind sets up a panel of judges, and they're flipping up cards, and they say, you know, 0.2. And that's spiritual. That's a spiritual battle. The enemy wants you to think that you're... If he can't get you to think you're nothing at all, he at least... wants you to think you're insignificant, and that what you do doesn't matter enough to be done. And I think the enemy loves emotions. What do you think? He knows that emotions have a big effect on people, so if he can get us to be, for whatever reason, feeling a certain way, he probably... be more likely to stop us. But Anybody having feelings here today? Anybody notice any feelings? Who's having no feelings? Anybody? No feelings whatsoever. Who doesn't want to answer my question? You know, when I was younger, I could describe, and younger is, you know, relative term, and the older you get, the more relative it is. But I could imagine myself. I got a better image than the one I was going to share with you. I used to go out early in the morning, or sometimes just in the middle of the day. I'd crawl into a little blind by a pond or something, and I would sit for hours just to get a chance to see certain animals really close. And sometimes I even tried to make little nature films with an 8mm movie camera, and you know those canisters or whatever they were of film. You know, you could get a whole 4 minutes on one of those things, and then you could play it with a projector or show it with a projector and watch the projector have a little problem and melt it into a whole bunch of bubbles. And I'd spent a lot of time trying to make those films. I still have a couple of them, actually. I don't know if I have a projector or two in my house, but I don't know if I can manage to show them right now. I've been thinking about showing them and using a digital camera to record the film on the screen. I guess you can take those places and have them made into something else, right? Anyway, this one day, I don't remember whether I was filming then or not, but kingfishers are one of my favorite birds, and if I named them all, you might say, well, they can't be favorites if you've got that many, especially if all the birds in the world are your favorite birds, you know. But at any rate, I was wanting to watch kingfishers catching frogs. So what I'm about to tell you is a description of me emotionally during a portion of my life. So, not the kingfisher. So this kingfisher comes and it lands on a branch and it's sitting there. And all of a sudden, it flies and it goes, boom, right into the water. And they kind of pull their wings in, hit the water, and then they come up and it had a frog in its mouth. And then it landed on the same branch. And it got that frog position, so it was holding it by the back legs. And it's sitting on the branch, and the branch is like this. And then it went, and that frog went whack, 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 whack against the branch. And I'd never seen one do that before, but it was really amazing. And I understood what it was doing, because if I was going to swallow a frog, I wouldn't want it jumping around in my stomach. But I'd want to scramble its brains first. And that's what it was doing. And that frog flying back and forth and smacking into that branch, I think, is a pretty good description of how I was emotionally during a good part of the early part of my life. And I didn't really realize that in some way I didn't realize that my emotions didn't actually govern or produce reality. And so I lived as though they were, in a lot of ways. And that can be really troublesome. When I was somewhere in my teens, I started to practice. It was a pretty simple thing. I don't exactly know where I got it, but I would feel a feeling, yeah. And that feeling might look like darkness that can be felt. And I would say, okay, well, that's how you feel. But that's not reality. And of course, you know, I believed the scriptures. I believed in Yeshua. I didn't think I was lost. That wasn't the problem. But simply telling myself the truth that my feelings were not actually the way the world was. Over and over I told myself that. I said, okay, that's what you're feeling. That's not reality. It's feelings, but they don't determine things. And you know, that's a pretty simple truth. Who thinks that's a pretty simple truth? Or, well, who thinks it's not the truth? First. Because if you do, I'm more interested in you at the moment than anybody else in the room. But, so, is it the truth? I mean, our feelings, you feel something, and so that's the way life is. That's the way the world is. That's the way things around you are because you have a feeling. Well, who thinks that? Good. Who acts like it? It's pretty easy to act that way, isn't it? It's pretty easy to feel a feeling and then act like, well, in fact, act like that is what God has spoken over you, that feeling. My inheritance is darkness that can be felt, says Yeshua. Right? We can, well, we might not actually quote that and put the words right in his mouth, but we probably come pretty close. We're trickier with ourselves than we even know. So, if we can act like a really negative feeling is reality, what does that produce then? It can actually generate, yeah, it can actually generate things that are real, right? So, like, if you're feeling really awful and you kick your cat, well, that seems like that's probably reality for the cat when your foot hits it. And it's probably reality that you are kicking the cat. I know people that have kicked cats. Somebody say something to me? I know people that have done all kinds of things to animals and people because of the way they were feeling, the way they were responding to something. Anything from a flat tire to, well, you name it. I mean, why would you flatten a person because you have a flat tire? Does that make any sense? So, what we do based on our feelings can generate reality, and it is reality that we feel what we feel. And it's a transgression to try to take someone's feelings away from them or act as though they don't exist, because feelings are real. If you're feeling a feeling, it's there. Anybody ever have a feeling that you weren't having? Anybody have a feeling that you were sure wasn't a real feeling? Yeah. I mean, most people, well, I don't know if it's most people, but, you know, psychosomatic pain, has anybody ever heard of psychosomatic pain? Is it real pain?
Yes.
Doesn't really matter if it's psychosomatic or if it's a nail stuck in your thigh. If you're feeling pain, it hurts. It actually hurts. And you can have referred pain and think it's right here and find out that that's, I mean, that's where you're feeling it, I guess, but it's coming from someplace else. That's kind of weird. And I've had like a real sharp like itch, almost feels like a bite sometimes, and scratched it like this, and then there's a spot somewhere on my back that lights up just the same as that, and I've always thought that's really interesting. Something, a lot of things are connected. So, anyway, So I've been sitting sometimes, and I'll get to what I'm going to talk about at some point here. But I've been sitting, you know, sometimes in the chair in the corner of my living room, and the sun might be shining through the window, and I'm feeling what I would call fine. And then all of a sudden, just felt completely different. Like, I mean, in like a split second, or, you know, very short amount of time, and just felt like I was, like maybe I was, you know, flying, riding thermals, you know, like the red tails do along Hurley Ridge, and all of a sudden the sun went out and my feathers all disappeared, and I'm plummeting toward the ground. I've had sudden changes of feeling like that many, many times in my life. And they were really disturbing when I was younger. And I suppose they could be at times now. But I got to a point where I would go, wow, that's really interesting. I mean, I was feeling like this. And now I'm feeling like this. And I thought, that's amazing. Like, how, you know, how different things can be. Like, I mean, what, I don't know what's going on, but that's like incredible. I mean, it's I'm just like interesting. And just kind of thought about it. And it seems like if I just think about it and then don't decide that I'm dead or that I'm dying or that my life's over or that terrible things are about to happen, that I'm okay. Does that make sense? It's like, oh, I'm feeling something, but my feeling isn't who I am, and everything is just exactly the same as it was a moment ago. All those things haven't changed, though. I could feel like everything's changed. I could feel like all the air went out of the tires on my vehicle, and I could feel like, you know, a messenger just arrived that gave me a message that's like what Job found. But you know what? If I'm feeling like that, I've found it actually doesn't mean that a horrible thing has even happened. And I've even begun to think, in some ways at least, it's not really that horrible to suddenly feel that way. Horrible. Maybe it's a temptation. I'm not even sure what it all is all the time. But what I am sure of is I do not have to be determined by what I feel like. And that when I feel a certain way that's really difficult or negative, I can make choices using the truth and my mind that do not go in the direction of what I'm feeling like. That go, in fact, in the opposite direction. Has anybody ever been on a long walk and gotten tired and wished you hadn't had to walk the rest of the way and even felt like just sitting down and never moving again? And did any of you just keep walking anyway? Even though the feeling was, I'm never going to get there, I'm not going to make it, I'm going to die before I get there, and you decided to keep walking, and then you got there? Then some of you have? It's funny how you can get there even if you feel like you're not going to, isn't it? Oh, you said it's funny. Like we should laugh. Yeah, I thought it was funny. So, when Judah blew the trumpet, the shofar, I was thinking about Judah, but I was thinking about people. I was thinking about me, I was thinking about all of you, I was thinking about all kinds of people. And I was also thinking about Judah, and I was thinking, yeah, about Judah. That's what I was thinking about Judah. I was thinking about all the times people do something that seems like a small thing, right? Or the times when they don't. But if they do it, sometimes they're thinking or feeling, oh, I shouldn't do this. oh, I looked stupid. Oh, it was a mistake. Oh, now I'm in trouble. And I used to imagine that people thought things about me, you know, what I did. I mean, even when I didn't really do much of anything. And you know how many years it took me to come to the place where, I don't know if it was in the same time frame or before, that I started saying, well, this is how you feel, okay. You feel like this, but this is not the way things are. This isn't reality. I began to realize, it's a deep mystery. Like, I like it when Paul says, I tell you a mystery. I'd like to feel like that felt. So I'm going to try it. I tell you a mystery. Mm-hmm. And this was a mystery. I began to suspect that my fears about what I looked like and how people responded to me and what they were thinking about me were almost entirely contained. I mean, my fears and the things that I thought maybe were the case were pretty much completely contained inside of me. So I was experiencing what I experienced. I was experiencing what they thought of me. I was experiencing their reaction, and they weren't experiencing anything. They weren't even thinking about me. But it was so powerful, the thought that they were thinking about me. And of course, you know, most of those people never told me what they thought of me, so it was up to me what they thought of me. And it was a lot of bad stuff those people thought about me when it was up to me what they were thinking. And most of them were never thinking any of those things. Now, just to be clear, there are people that have thought things about me. Some of them, even in this room, have thought things about me. And there are people that have thought really nasty things about me, and some of them have come and told me. One of them even said, I see nothing good in you at all. And that's, of course, you know, always makes my day when I hear someone talk to me like that. I go my way rejoicing. It's the natural response. Haven't you had that? Or has maybe no one's ever told you that? Has anyone else here ever had someone tell you that they saw no good in you whatsoever? That was just a little piece of what was said, by the way. It was a lot longer than that. And that particular occasion is very memorable to me, but not for the reason that you might imagine. That was the first time somebody really viciously attacked me. Just went up one side of me and down the other side. I stood there and I just looked at the person. I didn't shake my head. I don't want them to feel bad. Mm-hmm. I just listened to them, and I just saw a human being. And I just saw their mouth moving, and I heard all the words, and not a one of them touched me. It didn't hurt me. It had no effect on me. That was a pretty new experience. I mean, I'd gotten a little better at not taking everything way too hard, way too seriously, but I was born that way. I mean, I'm still getting over my trip through the birth canal, you know? You know? So, anyway, I remember thinking, wow. I don't feel anything about that except, you know, I could have said, so now tell me where it hurts. Like, what happened to you? I'd actually like to know. I didn't say that. But what I realized was what was being said to me was not about me at all. It had nothing to do with me. It had something to do with who knows how many other things that I couldn't possibly know about this person. But it had nothing to do with me. It wasn't about me. You could have just switched me with any number of other people and the same thing would have happened in the same situation. And it was... See, I believe on the one hand, everything is personal. Everything. Because in the world of people, I've discovered, both for myself and for other people, from what I can gather, don't things get taken personally? And when somebody says, I just want you to know, this isn't personal. It never feels personal after that, right? No, it feels like two or three knives instead of just one. A friend of mine used to always say, nothing personal, just business. And he didn't. I mean, it was a tongue-in-cheek thing. I mean, it was a sarcastic thing. Another friend once said to me what I just said to you, everything is personal. And in some sense, everything is. But that doesn't mean you have to take everything personally. But really, what that happens between human beings isn't personal. It's persons relating to persons. And we take things personally, you know, in a bad way that were completely our interpretation a lot of the time, that don't have anything to do with the other person. But when we're dealing with people, we should probably think, well, everything's personal, so let's exercise care. But, so I realized, I think on that occasion the enemy was trying to do me harm. But there was no harm. It was a very difficult person, but I did actually feel for them. And all that nasty stuff didn't hurt me. But I'm not very hard to hurt, just so you know. I'm not claiming that I became made of emotional and spiritual Kevlar. I didn't. But something about reality and who I was in the world, according to God, I guess had come far enough that it changed the way I experienced things. And I'm still a work in progress when it comes to all of that. But I think, you know, the world's full of wounded people, lost people, hurting people. Some people that are satisfied, you know, I mean, they're actually, you know, kind of happy with stuff. They think they're doing all right, but they're not. But they don't know. Some of them don't know. A lot of them do know. A lot of them are desperate, but they're desperately trying to keep you from knowing that because it's dangerous to be vulnerable. And so they act like they're fine. And knowing who we are and what our protection is and where the real danger is and what we're here for, according to the gospel, is really important. And feelings and how we handle them and the things we think about ourselves can end up dictating for us a reality that is not the reality of our redemption. They can stop us from telling the truth because we're afraid, because we think we're not good enough, or any number of things. Fear of being rejected. Rejection feels good, right? Anyone here ever experienced any rejection? You didn't want to feel it again, right? I don't really like rejection. I imagine Yeshua didn't even enjoy being rejected. What do you think? Did you think he enjoyed rejection? I don't think so. But what's the highest value in life? Avoiding rejection? Avoiding feeling pain because of having done something meaningful that could end up causing you pain? What's the highest meaning? What has God called us to? Has He called us to be as comfortable as possible, to avoid pain as much as possible, to avoid difficult things as much as possible, and to take the path of least resistance and get around things without going through any difficulty? Is that what He has for us?
No, that's electricity that
does that. Yeah, and sometimes I've been the path of least resistance. What?
And taking the path of least resistance kills.
Yeah, it's. I've had some interesting experiences with electricity in my life. I got stuck on an electric fence one time in Wisconsin when I was about 6. And that was the kind that didn't pulse once a second, it was continuous. Back then, technology was a little cruder and sometimes harsher.
A lot more painful.
And it turned me into what I would describe as a combination of overcooked spaghetti and wet Kleenex. And I finally, finally that wire that I was snagged on, somehow it came off. It was pretty intense. Do you think it's a true statement that what doesn't kill you makes you stronger?
No.
I don't. I've known people that weren't killed by a whole lot of things that happened to them. And they got more and more withdrawn and more suspecting trouble all the time and more just trying to avoid everything. But none of it killed them. But we can get stronger after whatever it is doesn't kill us, I think. The scriptures, you know, I know all of your favorite parts of the scriptures are the ones that talk about perseverance and how, you know, rejoicing in tribulation and how getting through things by God's grace teaches you perseverance and works character and develops you into more and more of what God is trying to shape you into. Aren't those your favorite passages? Aren't they? Well, they should be because they're true. And so if they're true, that means that everything that we get through where we're listening to the Lord and we're trying, you know, seeking to obey Him and believing that He's doing what He says, because He is doing what He says He's doing. It actually makes you better, makes you more resilient. You develop understanding and self-control unless you're always bracing yourself against it and fighting against it and trying to live a life that gets around all of that. See, then you'll just get more and more brittle. And then things will start to crack you. And then at some point, if it goes on long enough and it's intense enough, it just might break you. I once used some pieces of metal in one of my messages. I showed, you know, I do some forging. And, you know, if you keep pounding on a piece of metal, when the heat's gone, it starts to get these little cracks and fractures and this grain structure gets disturbed. But now, with a piece of metal, I've always noticed when I put it into the forge, it never squirms and tries to get away from me or get out of my tongs. It just goes into the fire. And when it comes out the right temperature and I start hitting it, no damage is done. You can form it, you can shape it, you can make it longer, you can make it thicker, you can make it thinner, you can make it go all over the place if you know how to hit it with a hammer, and a hammer doesn't hurt it. But see, our God is a fire, right? A consuming fire. Those three guys, they didn't burn up in that furnace. I think they were inside of a fire that was in the fire with them. The fire of God consumes things. It destroys things that reject Him and resist Him. But it does no harm to the things that are submitted to it. It's very interesting. And so, if you fight the fire, so to speak, then I think what happens is you stay cold, and then when the forming blows come, you get brittle and you start to fracture. So, you know, I really think, I think the Lord's trying to tell us that we don't need to be afraid of Him, that we can trust Him, that He can bring us through it. You know what it is? I can tell. You know, my eyes aren't as good as they used to be, but I can tell you all know what it is. Right? Do you? Am I putting you to sleep? Is it warm in here? I want to tell all of you that I appreciate everything you've gone through in this congregation. I appreciate that you show up again. I appreciate that you've been here as long as you've been here and that you're not now somewhere else. I appreciate that. I appreciate that you blew the shofar. I appreciate that you get up and read something. I appreciate the things you cook and bring here. I appreciate the things that you say to me and to other people. I count it a privilege to have gone through difficult things with some of you. You can decide whether I have or not. I count it a privilege to have gone through things that weren't difficult with all of you, things that were difficult with all of you, and I count it a privilege to have been so terribly imperfect and all sorts of other things, and that you still love me. And I love all of you. I wonder how often some of us or all of us start wondering whether people do still love us. I don't know, maybe we should tell each other a lot more often. But you know, I'm looking around and I can tell all of you that I appreciate you, that I actually love you. I don't know how many cups of coffee Clark's given me over the years. There are a lot of little things that matter, and some of them that don't even seem like they matter more than we think they do. You matter. And you're going to make it to the end of the journey. And you're going to hear the Lord tell you, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And the age to come is not composed of the same thing that we have been going through here. And it's also way, way longer. Can anyone tell me how much longer? I can't. I mean, forever is a big concept. Eternity seems so much longer than 70 or 80 or 90 years. So, oh, I forgot. I was going to ask you, how are you doing at loving yourself? I think I said something about that last week. How are you doing at loving yourself? Who wants to love their neighbor? Who is aspiring to love their neighbor exactly the way that they are loving themselves? Who wants to love their neighbor better than they're loving themselves? Oh, so, you know, I'm beginning to suspect, maybe I have for a long time, that the hardest person for you to love is you. I suspect that. And people aren't, other than us, aren't, I really don't think they're easier to love than we are. I think they're, you can act like it, but I think it's easy to love people only to the extent that you love yourself, and then to the extent that you don't, it sometimes gets to be overwhelming, the things we feel about ourselves. So then what we do is it's something like throwing up, and we put it on other people because we have to let it out once in a while. So, does it sound like a selfish assignment if I told you I really think that the Lord is assigning you the task of loving yourself? Does that sound selfish?
No.
Loving yourself. Loving yourself really well. And then doing that to other people. You're worth loving. You're worth your own love for yourself. Because God loves you. And he wants us to be secure in being his children, knowing that his love doesn't change when we're less than perfect, which is all the time. And if we have mercy for us, and we don't have contempt for ourselves, and we're not disgusted or tired of ourselves, simpler to love other people. I'm pretty sure the moments I've been the nastiest to other people were the times when I felt the worst about myself. So, this seems related to me. Something, you know, I mean, it comes up here and there all over the place. But to the Jew first, and also to the Gentile. And the Messianic movement, as a movement, which is a very broad and variegated quagmire of all sorts of gook, and some great stuff, has in some ways created a great identity problem for some people, in that it hasn't necessarily treated people as though they're all just human beings first. And so I don't know, can anybody tell me, what do you think to the Jew first means? Can anybody tell me what you think it means? God love a Jewish person more than a non-Jew? Is it better to be Jewish than not to be Jewish? Two heads shaking, everyone else poker-faced. Let's see, the Messianic congregations, they have the true worship, and the church is either not very good or no good at all? Is that how it is? What do you think? Yeah, I'm going to read you part of the 11th chapter of Romans. I'll read the first part. I say then, God has not rejected his people, has he? May it never be. For I too am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people whom he foreknew. Or do you not know what the scriptures says in the passage about Elijah, how he pleads with God against Israel? Lord, they have killed thy prophets, they have torn down thine altars, and I alone am left, and they are seeking my life. But what is the divine response to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. In the same way, then, there has also come to be at the present time a remnant according to God's gracious choice. But if it is by grace, it is no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace is no longer grace. What then? That which Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained, but those who were chosen obtained it, and the rest were hardened. Does it sound like everybody spoken of in that verse is Israel? The hardened ones and the unhardened ones? You know? Anybody have an opinion?
Yes.
Do we have an exegete in the house? What? Are you afraid to answer because you're afraid you might be wrong? You need to read the verse off your own page?
Peter, I don't understand the question.
Ah, that's a very clear statement. Thank you. What then? That which Israel is seeking for, it has not obtained. So who didn't obtain what it was seeking? Who they were seeking?
Israel.
What they were seeking?
Israel.
Israel was seeking something, didn't obtain it, right? But those who were chosen obtained it. Who are those?
Some of Israel.
Part of Israel, right?
Yeah, the remnant.
And the rest were hardened. Who are the hardened ones?
Israel. Part of Israel.
It doesn't seem that there's anyone in that verse that's being spoken of that's not actually Israel. Just as it is written, God gave them the spirit of a stupor. Who is that?
Israel. The ones who were hardened.
The ones who were hardened. Very good. Eyes to see and not... Stupor. Eyes to see and ears to hear not.
Eyes that would not see.
Eyes to see not and ears... to hear not, down to this very day. Who's that?
Israel. The part of Israel that was hardened.
Okay, so there are people that rejected Yeshua, that didn't obtain what they were seeking, that Paul over and over and over calls Israel, right?
Yeah, part of Israel.
Part of Israel. But nonetheless, Israel. And the part that's not hardened is part of what?
Israel.
And Israel is still Israel. One people even hardened and unhardened, or those, okay? And David says, let their table become a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a retribution to them. Let their eyes be darkened to see not and their and bend their backs forever. Who's David speaking of?
Those of Israel who are hardened.
It sounds so terribly harsh. It's disturbing. I say then they did not stumble so as to fall, did they? May it never be. But by their transgression salvation has come to the Gentiles to make them jealous. Now if their transgression be riches for the world and their failure be riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their fulfillment be? Who's going to be fulfilled in there?
Israel.
What Israel? What? The part that was hardened. But I am speaking to you who are Gentiles, inasmuch then as I am an apostle of Gentiles, I magnify my ministry, if somehow I might move to jealousy my fellow countrymen and save some of them. Does anybody feel insulted to think that Paul was motivated to reach non-Jews, even if his primary motivation was that his own people come to faith when he was trying to reach people that weren't his own people? Does that sound like an insult or like you don't matter?
Nope.
But you're Jewish.
Yes.
Which is great. But a Gentile might feel differently.
On one hand, it does feel like a, I don't know, whatever you were saying.
An insult?
A slight?
Yeah.
Like you're not that great.
If you're not thinking that Paul himself was a Jew and that his heart was for his people.
If you're not thinking that he was?
If you're only focused on the fact that, well, you, a Gentile, are a Gentile, and that is the whole mix or non-mix. If there is no... Okay.
And this Jewish guy, Paul, wants you to come to faith so that his people will be jealous and that they'll come to faith.
I'm, like I said, on one hand, if you're just thinking that, you're focused on yourself and the fact that you feel slighted because of that, you're going to feel slighted. But if you keep in mind that Paul himself was a Jew and that his heart was for his people, I think it makes it a totally different story.
We'll have to continue this discussion.
You could feel slighted or you could feel privileged.
I don't think Paul is reaching the Gentiles only to make Israel jealous.
I believe that Paul deeply loved everybody that he reached out to, the Gentiles and the Jews alike. I don't believe that he first went to the Jews in each place he went to because he thought Jews were better or loved them more. I don't believe that's why. I do believe that he did not say that I could wish myself accursed for the sake of the Gentiles, though. And I've known a lot of people who have family members that they want to come to faith. And in those people, I often notice that there seems to be something that drives them and grips them more about their own family than other people that they witness to. And I've never thought that that meant that they don't care or that they think those people are second-class citizens or anything. Just there's, you know, there can be just something inside you that drives you about your people or your family. But, I can't go too far into this but right now, I think we need to take a closer look at the subject. But it's very interesting. The sages of the Talmud, you know how they saw Israel? First of all the unfaithful people in Israel, they see basically as they end up. They're no different than the nations. They don't have a share in the age to come, according to the Talmud. The Israel the sages saw, which is holy Israel, not the state of Israel, was a multicolored group of people surrounded by a big group called the Gentiles that are all white. Now, I mean, white, I don't mean Caucasian. I just mean it's a differentiation, right? And the defining characteristic of a Gentile is idol worshiper, according to those sages. And anybody who is not an idol worshiper, who worships the God of Israel, has a share in the age to come, and according to the sages, everyone who has a share in the age to come is part of Israel. Mm-hmm. And so when Ephesians, Paul talks in Ephesians about one new man, see, and I think the concept gets used in ways that are, well, that I don't think are quite right. But the sages of the Talmud, regardless of what they were wrong about, I think did get a lot of things right, and I think that Paul's thinking is the kind of thinking that the sages had, because he was trained in the same sort of discourse and examination of things. Everything in the world is subject to what they call Torah, which is more than just the five books of Moses. And in the end, there will be one new humanity. And it's not made up of a genetic block. It's made up of those were faithful to the God of Israel, regardless of where they came from. And the sages see that whole mass as one, whether they're descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob or not. There are some little differentiations. I don't think there is no necessity in terms of the gospel to place a value on people that is different based on who they descended from. And God is not partial, and he doesn't respect persons. And Yeshua said to people that claimed that Abraham was their father, he says, whoop-dee-doo. The father can raise up descendants of Abraham from these stones. You think you're hot stuff? It's meaningless if you're not in the right place. If you aren't accepting the truth, he was telling them that what you're depending on is nothing. It's wood and stubble. It's going to just burn up. That's not what it's about. So if God's not partial and he's not a respecter of persons, and he's after one new humanity and not a genetic group of people, then the whole story of redemption is something far bigger and far more wonderful and far more full of blessing and riches for everybody, regardless of where they came from, than maybe any of us have yet realized. But you know, Jews get tribulation first. Salvation came to them first. Judgment comes to Israel first. Then to the Gentiles. I mean, they get it from both ends, regardless of what it is, first. And to whom much is given, much is required. And much was given to Israel, and parts of Israel will have much required of them for what they did with it. There's just one thing that makes things different for any person, and that is the blood of Yeshua.
That's right.
And theologically and in terms of how everything works out on the face of the earth, there are things that matter. And Israel does matter in that. But it doesn't matter because it's the best or the greatest. In fact, if anything I was going to argue, I'd say it matters because they're the least and possibly even the worst. At least during parts of their history. I mean, you got to be careful what you say, because if anybody quotes a piece of it and doesn't quote all of it, then you know, you sound like a monster. I believe what part of what Paul saw was, see, he sees Israel in a massive sense finally coming back to God. And the rabbis of the sages, the sages of the Talmud, see it in essentially the same way, but not according to Yeshua. That when Israel is faithful, God gathers the Gentiles. And what it says in that passage, and maybe I quit reading before I got there, but what will their fulfillment be but life from the dead? That's Israel turning to God. Israel being true to God. And the result is God reaches out his arms and gathers in all the peoples of the earth in a bigger way than anybody has ever seen. And I know preachers that don't believe in anything, but things are going to get worse and it's all over and there's practically no reason to pray for. Actually, some of them say there is no reason to pray for revival. They don't believe that God's going to do anything much more. I believe that this thing with Israel is going to happen, and it's going to be life from the dead, that there's going to be a bigger ingathering than anybody's ever seen in all of history. And Israel, yeah, Israel is caught up in it, but it's about the whole world. It's about all of humanity. It's about Adam and Noah and whoever's born on the last day of human history. It's about everybody. It's about what God started when he created the world. And Israel gets both the glory and the shame, the benefit and the agony of being at the core of it all through history. And I might have liked to have been over all of Egypt like Joseph, but I don't know that I would have wanted to go through what he went through. So when we think we're less, we're probably wrong. When we wish we had what somebody else had, it's probably usually we want to go what they went through to get there. But the stunning and amazing thing is that there's redemption.
That's right.
And it came to me. And it came to you. And all that other stuff about my ego just disappears when I look at that. So, anyway, it's been fun. I hope it's been useful. And you're all going to make it. Encourage yourself, no matter what you're feeling like.